Today is Wednesday, March 31st, 1976. Today's interview is with Mr. Charlie Simmons of 815 Henderson Avenue in Beloit, Wisconsin. My name is Clem Imhoff. Mr. Simmons, let's start with your family's background in Kentucky. Let's just start with your parents' names, where they were from, their background in Kentucky, as far as you can, even going back to your grandparents and great-grandparents, if you can recall that.
I can only go back as far as my grandmother and my grandfather. They were born as slaves on my mother's side, and those are the ones that I know mostly. They were born in Kentucky. My grandmother's name was Laura Logan before she married my grandfather, whose name was Marion Price. And he had about five or six daughters, and I don't remember how many sons. But my mother was about the third daughter, I think. Her name was Kate Price. Later she married Walter Simmons, who was my father. We had, in our family, it was four children. My oldest sister, who is Emma Thomas at the present time. My had another sister whose name I do not remember. She died before I was born. I had a brother by the name of Marion. We called him Sam. Later on, my mother went to St. Louis. I stayed in Louisville with my grandparents, and my mother and father separated, and I stayed in Louisville and went to school at what was known as the Benjamin Banneker School, and to the eighth grade. Then we came to Beloit.
Do you know how far back your family's background went in Kentucky? Had they been in Kentucky as far as you were aware?
As far as I know of, they were Kentuckians. My grandfather, I think, came from around, what was it? I don't remember just exactly what part of Kentucky, but it was in the... It was up around Harridge Creek or someplace up in there. I don't remember just exactly where it was. And, well, I don't know. He worked as a carpenter when he was able to work. Later he was to the place. Well, he built several houses in Louisville. And he was very handy with tools. And always worked for himself, very independent, which I was very proud to know of him being that. Very straight, strict, religious person. I don't know, I look back over his record, and I often wish that I could be the man that he was. He was really remarkable. And when we came to Beloit, why, my mother had remarried and had came to Beloit, and she had a daughter, which is my half-sister, Elizabeth. Her name was Elizabeth Mayo. We came to Beloit. And my two nephews, my oldest sister, had two boys, Charles and Curtis. And in fact, we were in our neighborhood. We were about the only black, we were the only black children in the neighborhood. And there was very few blacks in the city of Beloit. At that time, we had one black church. It was Bethlehem Church. And naturally, we had to attend some church, so that was the church that we attended. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the year. It must have been 8 or 10 years after we came here that, well, let's see, about 5 years, 5 or 6 years after we came here, why the immigration started. The first, after I got old enough, I got a job at Fairbanks Morris. And I was employed there as a guide, taking people through the shop and taking new employees to their boss or the foreman, whoever it would be. And at that time, just before that, I got acquainted with John McCord. He came in here. I don't know how long he'd been here, and he was employed as a janitor. Mm-hmm. And he was in charge of cleaning the main office of Fairbanks. And they were having quite a bit of trouble trying to keep employees. That's the beginning of the war.
Now, when you say they're having trouble keeping employees, just what kind of trouble were they having?
Well, they wouldn't stay. Well, they would send to Chicago and get fellows to come here and work, and they wouldn't work. And they had so much work that they couldn't hire enough men. So,
were these white immigrants from Europe,
were immigrants? They were just stragglers out of Chicago that laid around these employment offices down on Canal Street and down in such places as that, and they couldn't get the help. So John McCord, a man that was employment agent at that time, his name was Eugene Burlingame. I'm getting a little ahead of my story there. I want to go back to this.
Okay, sure.
Because my father, before I was employed there, a man by the name of Ed Curtis, my stepfather, had worked for at the Union Station in St. Louis, and later he came to Chicago and worked for him. He was a master mechanic. He had charge of different buildings.
Now, your father worked for, or it was your stepfather?
Stepfather.
Who worked for Ed Curtis?
Ed Curtis.
In
St. Louis.
Right. Now, your stepfather's name was?
Robert Mayo. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he came to Chicago.
And now, could you spell your stepfather's name? I'm not sure.
Mayo. Robert Mayo.
Okay.
And then he came to after being in Chicago, why Curtis found out that he was there. He had the job here in Beloit and sent for him to come up here. He needed firemen. So my stepfather came up here. That's where we moved. That's when we moved up here. We moved up here through Curtis. And through Curtis, of course, that's the reason why I received the job, because being the son of Bob Mayo. And I got the job in the office. John McCord came in the office one day, and he spoke to Burlingame about he could get some boys to come to Beloit, and told Burlingame that where they were in Mississippi. So they agreed, and they sent John McCord off to get these men. I think the first group of men he brought back was about 15 or 16 men he brought back. And they went to work. Well, after they came up and they went in the foundry and started working, they worked out all right. Then they built a camp down at the corner of Pleasant and Lawton for these men. And they went back and brought up more. And some of them started coming on the train, but John went back and got more. And then he made several trips down, brought fellas up. But then it was to the place where it was dangerous for John to go back down there, because the whites down there were against him bringing up their employees. So then they had to send somebody else. So Walter Ingram, I think, went down. He brought up several. And different ones did, until the population began to grow. The black population began to grow in Beloit. And so, but in the meantime, I want to put this in too. In the meantime, there were any number of whites that didn't come up with this group, but they followed these blacks up here. It was quite a number of whites came along behind them. And
you mean white folks from Mississippi? And
yeah, and the poor, see, it was the poor whites that were working on share crop like the blacks were.
Do you recall the names of some of these poor white families who came up from?
No, I do not. I don't recall any of the names of them, but I know there was some there, because later on why they said that they were from Mississippi. Yeah, so.
Now, on John McCord, still, what do you recall about his family, where he came from, how he got to Beloit, and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't remember just exactly how John got here, but I know he sent back. He brought his brothers, and yet later on, after his brothers came, well, they sent back and got his parents, his mother and father, and they lived here. In fact, they died here, the parents and all, quite a few of his relatives, uncles and aunts and things of that kind. But
do you know where his home was? Or
his home was in Pontotoc. In fact, the city of Blood is small Pontotoc.
Sure, I know. So John McCord, then, was the original connection to Pontotoc.
John McCord was the original from Pontotoc. He started the Pontotoc. Also, the Ripley and New Albany. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you tell us a little bit more about how he got that job as a labor recruiter? How did he come up with this idea that he could get these mm-hmm. workers from Mississippi?
Well, working in the office with, he was a janitor, and he was in charge of the janitor work there. And he came in the office, and Mr. Burlingame was a very nice person to talk to. And he was talking to Mr. Burlingame about, somehow or another, they came up about these men coming and not staying. And he said that he could go south and get some men for him. And at the time, I don't know whether John really meant that or whether he was jokingly and said it. But the first group that came, one of the remarkable things, it's a little comical, but I'll put it in anyways.
That's good.
I was in the employment office, and I worked in there. So John wrote a letter back, which is his penmanship was very bad. And Burlingame couldn't understand it. No one in the office couldn't understand it. So he handed it to me. He said, "Charlie, can you make this out?" I looked at it. And I said, "No, but I'll run upstairs and look in the atlas." So I ran upstairs and looked through the atlas, and I found the only place in Mississippi that looked like potato. That's what I said it looked like, potato, Mississippi. And the only place that I could find in Mississippi that looked like potato was Pontotoc. And I taken it back down and told him. So that's where he had to send the money, the transportation, for this first group of men. The first group of men came, and they were elderly, and some of them, I think, had never been no city. We had in the basement, had an exhaust fan. In the basement, it didn't have a guard over it. And during that time, it wasn't so much safety as it is today. So this fellow stood there and looked at that fan humming away, and his name was Cliff White. Never will forget it. He went up to this fan and I guess wanted to see how it was running, stuck his fingers in there and knocked all his knuckles off. Just the skin off his, didn't knock his, just knocked the skin off his, the knuckles of his hand. And as a boy, as I was, crazy, didn't have all my marbles, I started laughing. So Burlingame gave me a good scolding about it. He said, take him on over to the Red Cross, to the hospital. Let him do something for him. Then they had to take him down to the camp that they had fixed for him. They called it a camp. It was just fixed like a barracks. Taking him down there, and he got a job down there as a flunky. He didn't have to do no work. He didn't have to go to the foundry till his fingers healed up. It was comical, some of those things.
The following material, about 15 or 20 minutes, is being recorded on April 9th, not March 31st, to compensate for an error in the original recording session. Mr. Simmons, I was wondering how John McCord got his job as a recruiter with Fairbanks Morris, and just exactly what his responsibilities were.
Well, he was a janitor at Fairbanks Morris in the office for a couple years. And the way he was very well liked among the people, all the people in the office. And well, they started the people hiring people from Chicago and different places, and they didn't work out very good. So John suggested to the employment, the personnel manager, that he could get some men from the South to come up here and work. So after talking with Mr. Burlingame about it, why, they decided to send John down. So John went south to Pontotoc and wrote a letter back that he had, at that time, I think 10 or 15 men to bring back. So Mr. Burlingame sent a wire down there to send some money down to John for transportation to these men to come to Beloit. That's the way it was. Of course, it was a comical thing that happened there, that John wasn't a very good writer, and he wrote the letter here, and they couldn't understand it. So they gave it to me to see if I could understand it, and I went upstairs and looked in the Atlas, and I looked through everything in Mississippi, and I couldn't find anything that looked like the word that, the postmark. We couldn't figure the postmark out. So we looked for potato. I looked for potato, and I found out that it was Pontotoc. It was the only place in Mississippi that seemed to correspond. And we sent the letter to John, the money to John, that way. So John brought them back, and that's the way it started as far as I can remember.
Yeah, I see. Now, you mentioned that Fairbanks Morris had been having problems with people that they'd recruited from Chicago, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that, just who were these people and what were the problems?
They were getting them from down around LaSalle Street, which were the slum area where the employment offices were. And they were hiring them from these various employment offices, and they were sending them out. They were paid to send them out here, but they wasn't supposed to, didn't care whether they worked or not as long as they sent them. So these fellows would come out this far and then keep going. So they wouldn't even go take off their clothes or anything and go to work. So therefore, they were having a big problem trying to get enough employees to work, so they were really up against it.
Now, you mentioned Mr. Burlingame a couple of times favorably. Apparently, he was, in your mind, quite a fair-minded person, and I was wondering if there was anything more you remember about his role in this whole recruiting business.
Well, Eugene Burlingame was a very fair-minded and a fair man all the way around, and is very he was a very decent person as a whole. And he considered things, and he went along. Well, he and I guess Mr. Ingersoll, who was the, at that time, was the assistant general manager of this, the works here, they talked it over and called in Mr. Curtis, who was the master mechanic, and they worked it out, the plans to have John to go, which Curtis would indirectly, the foreman of John McCord, who I spoke before, was also my father's foreman, a superintendent, rather.
Now, how did Mr. McCord ever talk to you about how he carried out this business as a labor recruiter? Now, I know that in some cases that was a fairly dangerous occupation. Did he ever talk to you about just how he did it and if he faced dangers? How did he avoid those dangers?
No, well, the way he only way he explained it to me, he knew. Well, that was where he was born and raised, was in that, around in those surroundings. And he knew all the old-time families. And he had had contact and writing to some of them about what he was doing here and how much money he was making and how well it was here for him to live. And they, after going back there, he talked to them, and they had most of the recruiting done when he got there. He had the men all gathered up. And all he had to do is get there with the transportation and get them together and bring them on up.
Mm-hmm. I see. All right. Now, what was he paid for this work? Do you recall?
That I do not know. That I couldn't say.
All right. And do you know just what potential workers were told about Beloit? What was the pitch to them to get them to come up here? Do you have any idea?
The only pitch that I haven't been told, but the only pitch that I knew, his John McCord's brother, after coming to Beloit, he became a very good friend of mine. We palled around a lot together. And so many things that he would say here, he would say that he wasn't able to do them in the South. And he was at liberty to do them here. And he felt that those liberties was worth something to him. And he never want to go back. So I presume that he just naturally had left something that was better than was worse than what he had, what he came to. So
now, once again, did John McCord ever talk about just exactly why he agreed to do this recruiting work?
No, he never did talk to me, but I can see how he felt. I think I can see how he felt. He had those were his relatives down there, and they were just barely living. They wasn't, they couldn't accomplish anything. They couldn't save anything. They would come up every year owing whoever owned the land, and they couldn't get ahead. So it was just like giving a child a toy. When they came up here, they had freedom, and they had was loose. They could do as they pleased, in one sense. And I really could see why they would want to leave there, just like any other person that in any other place that wasn't allowed to do various things, and food was poor, or the clothing was poor, or they didn't have the money, couldn't go to school like other children. The parents couldn't afford to send them to school. Well, that made a difference.
Now, did he ever in the first place, how often did he go down, and over what span of time was this, do you recall?
Well, I couldn't definitely see how what the span was, but there in the, I would say inside of, oh, 2 or 3 months, I think he had made 2 or 3 trips down there. But that didn't last long, because after he had made so many trips down there, why, he began to get to the place where he was afraid to go there, because his life would be in danger. As I was told, I don't know, but that's what I was told, his life was in danger of going there, because what he was doing was bringing the hands from the man that down there that had the property, the large plantation, is bringing his help away from there up here to work. So naturally it was prejudice there.
Did he ever talk about any specific experience where there was where there were dangers involved that he...
Not to me, he didn't. He was a person that never, if he was in danger, he wouldn't hardly tell you.
Why, now I gather then that he quit this work because of the danger. Was there any other factor involved in his quitting?
No, I think he quit it because he was, the danger was involved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, were there any other recruiters besides John McCord that Fairbanks Moore sent down to Mississippi or elsewhere that you knew or knew about?
Yes, Walter Ingram was one, and I think it was one or two more, but it don't come to me right now just who they were, but I know Walter Ingram was one.
And how did you know Mr. Ingram?
Well, Mr. Ingram was one of the first ones that came to Beloit with John, and later on I learned of him. Well, I got acquainted with him through his family, some of his people came to Beloit, and, well, naturally, he came through the office, and I was working in the office, and naturally I'd come in contact with him quite a bit. And being younger, why, he always picked after me or kidded me or something of that kind.
You mentioned that he's younger. How old was John McCord about the time that he was recruited?
John McCord at that time, I would say he was right around in his 30s, mm-hmm. early 30s.
Okay. Now, once again, with Walter Ingram, how did he manage to get into this this recruiting business?
Well, John naturally got him in it. Walter was a little better. Had went to school a little longer than John had, and he knew how to maneuver a little better than John did, and he would listen to John, and John, then he knew how to get in and out of Mississippi, because he also played baseball, kind of a semi-pro baseball down in there, so he knew the ins and outs.
Now, by the ins and outs, just what do you mean by that? What were the ins and outs?
Well, he knew how to get into Ripley, New Albany, and Pontotoc. See, because he was better known among the people, and by him going in, they would just think that he was coming in there, as he always has, to play ball or something of that kind, just visiting with the black people at that time. Of course, at that time, you couldn't say black.
Right.
You better not say black back there, because if you did, it was a fighting word.
Exactly. Since you mentioned that, what was the term that you preferred in referring to what...
That I prefer now?
Now and then.
I prefer this. I prefer to be called Charles Simmons.
Right.
As an American. Not as a black man, because I am not black. And I'd rather be called a Negro, because I wouldn't like the word black, black, and I don't like the word nigger. See, and I don't like colored because didn't nobody color me. Right. See, and
Well, that's an interesting digression here, but I want to ask a couple of other questions about Walter Ingram before we get too far afield here. Once again, and these are pretty much the same questions that I had concerning Mr. McCord. Did Walter Ingram ever talk with you about why he decided to get involved in the recruiting?
No, he didn't ever talk to me on that because, as I said before, Walter was older than I was. And I was one of his brothers. He had a brother that came up later. He and I would talk about things. And, Walter brought his brother. In fact, three brothers. He brought three brothers up here. There was Wes Ingram and Arthur Ingram and Jim Ingram. But all of them, two of them went back, and one has passed. And none of the Ingrams is here yet. But there are some Ingrams here, but they're grandchildren or something of that kind.
Now, is Walter still living?
Walter's still living in Racine. He's a minister. No. Very well-liked person. He's very intelligent, so he's nobody's dummy, so he's good, pretty good fellow.
Did he ever talk about any particular experiences or incidents
when
in recruiting?
He never did. Yeah. No, I did. As far as recruiting was concerned, I guess it never came to cross my mind to wonder why these fellows went backwards and forwards down there, other than to bring some of their relatives or some of their friends up.
Did either John McCord or Walter Ingram go anywhere beyond their home area, the Pontotoc, Ripley, New Albany area? Did they ever go elsewhere?
Not that I know of. They went Ripley, New Albany, Pontotoc, right in that area. There was several little towns right around there. Mm-hmm. Holly Springs, I think, was another town. They all right in there. In one area.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, once again, how long did Mr. Ingram, or Reverend Ingram now, continue as a recruiter? Do you know?
I really don't know, but not very long, because after so long, after those recruiters, as you call them, started, those fellows started going down, well then, it was enough of them here then that they would send back and get their parents or some of their friends, or they would send them money to come up themselves or seek jobs for them or intercede for jobs for them. So they didn't have to send anybody after their group started coming in and were well satisfied. See, another thing that I think really happened, I think this should be said too, that in the beginning, the biggest majority of the fellows that came up were younger fellows. Those that were not young, they were people that lived on the farms or of some landlord or something of that kind. But you take the other people, they see it's a group that just came up here on visits, and they went back. They were established. They had their own homes. And they were doing fine down there. So those people never came. They never left there. They stayed there. They're still there, a lot of them. But see, some of them that didn't have no property, didn't have no land, didn't have nothing but just what they could get from the landlord. Why? In other words, those people that came up here were the poor class. They didn't have anything. So that's really the picture of the whole thing.
That's a good point. Now, as far as you know, did either Walter Ingram or John McCord leave any written accounts of their experience?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of.
And are there any people living in Racine or in the Beloit area today that they would have confided in, that they might have talked to fairly extensively about these experiences that you would know of?
Well, nearly everybody in this Beloit area that they would probably have talked to have passed. Mm-hmm. See, the older ones that were in their category, why, they have passed on now. See, for instance, like John was about 15 or 20 years older than I was. So I had to make those people up better than 100 now. So they wouldn't be around. So
I was afraid of that.
Yeah, that's where it is now. So
it would really be interesting to talk with some people that they'd known.
It is maybe one man here that would probably know something about him. But whether he'd talk or not, I don't know. I think you have talked to his daughter, who is Miss Bond. And her father's name is Zach White. Now, he probably would know something that, but he's about the only one that I know here that would be up in that bracket where he could have talked to John and John could have told him something, because he's about the only one that I know of around here that up in that age bracket.
This concludes the material recorded on April 9th on this tape. The balance of the tape, which will begin in about 3 minutes, was recorded on March 31st at the original session.
I don't remember who it was.
Okay, you were talking about, we were talking here about recruiting, and you'd mentioned that...
My mother had went to St. Louis because she had some friends there, and she went to work there, and later my older brother, he went to St. Louis, and that's where he learned the molding, trade of molding in St. Louis. And in the meantime, after he went to St. Louis, my mother married Robert Mayo, and then Robert Mayo worked at the Union Station in St. Louis as a fireman under Ed Curtis. Ed Curtis got a job in Chicago and sent for Bob Mayo to come to Chicago with him, and he came to Chicago with Curtis, and Curtis stayed there in Chicago for a while, and then he came to Fairbanks here in Beloit and sent for Bob Mayo to come to. So that was recruiting right there. So that's the way Bob Mayo, that's the way we got to Beloit. It's through the recruiting of Curtis.
But sure. Of course, oftentimes it was informal. It wasn't really an organized.
No, it wasn't organized. It was informal. But as you said, it's so often in the South or anywhere. You take so many of our friends left Louisville and went to. They would either go to Indianapolis, Indiana, or go to St. Louis. Then their next move from St. Louis would be Chicago. Or the next move from Indianapolis would be Chicago. That's the way my dad, of course, my own father, he was worked on the railroad. He was a railroad porter. And he ran on the road from Chicago, from Louisville to Chicago. And so many of his friends did follow. He went to Chicago and he found out about Chicago, and I guess a lot of his friends did the same thing. This is just one of those incidents. And
since you mentioned Louisville here, and I'd like to get back to that a little bit and ask if just what you recall about living in Louisville. What stands out in your mind about living in Louisville?
Several things stand out in my mind as a child. Well, in Louisville, well, I went to school there. That was my first school. Schooling that I received was from Louisville. And, well, every summer after I think, passed the fourth grade, Churchill Downs, they'd take us to Churchill Downs every year after we left the fourth grade, I think it was. And that was something to always look forward to. Lastly, excuse me.
So you were recalling some of your experiences living in Louisville.
Yes. I've seen Ohio River. Wasn't too far from the last place that my grandfather lived. And during that time, I experienced some floods. I experienced two floods down in Louisville when I was a kid. One was in 1907, and the other one was about 1909 or 10, something like that. And I never, of course, that was two things that stood out in my mind, because a person never knowing what a flood was, that they had to leave their home and leave in a hurry. Well, it's something, then go back and look at your house. Maybe you could see your house, and all you could see was a chimney. And then after the flood was over, the house would still be standing there. It was something that, I don't know, it's a lot of things in Louisville that, I don't know, as a child I didn't have too much recollection of it, because I was too young to remember too many things about it. A cousin I got, her and I, we were raised up like sisters and brothers. And she too was, well, we still are very close.
Now, the what about white-black relations in Louisville? We've talked about that a little bit.
White and black, as far back as I can go, the relationship with us there, it didn't seem to be so much in my childhood, because my grandfather was, as I stated before, was very strict and stern. He would call you black if you told a lie, did something. He'd call you a black lie as quick as he would call me one. That's the way he, if you did something that was dirty, he'd say it's black. And, well, that's a, but as far as the whites always treated us just the same as we were any, well, we played together, we did everything together. The neighbors, we lived in a neighborhood, was nothing but white for a while there. And my grandfather built houses in neighborhoods where it was nothing but white. And he's very, so far as the relationship, white and black, why, it was, I couldn't see much difference. When I got here, I couldn't see much difference, because it wasn't too much Jim Crow in there, as they call it, where... The only thing that you noticed more so than anything else, the white schools and black schools. The schools were segregated. But other than that, why? You get on a streetcar, you didn't have to go in the back seat of no streetcar.
You indicated earlier that your grandfather apparently had a good bit of success as a carpenter in Louisville.
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm. He had very good success building.
Was he able to continue that when he came to Beloit?
No, he was too old when he came here. See, my grandfather, when he got here, he was about 70-some years old. So he wasn't able to do anything after he got here.
Do you recall any, before we leave your grandfather, do you recall any stories that he might have told you about his earlier days as a slave, maybe at the time of freedom. Is there anything that stands out in the family's memory that way?
I can't remember anything in slavery that he told me about. I can't remember anything of that type.
Yeah, just not necessarily about slavery, but any stories from his earlier days that might be interesting to people now.
I can't remember.
Okay.
I can tell you this, one is kind of comical, though, too, again. My grandmother and grandfather, all of us, well, they had at our home, we had, like a grape harbor and had quite a few fruit trees in our yard. And we were sitting out there, my cousin and I were running around there playing, and a man rolled up in a real nice horse and buggy. It wasn't the automobiles at that time. A horse and buggy rolled up in it. And he slipped up behind my grandmother and put his hands over her eye. And he was a white man. He put his hands over her eye. And I went to get a rock. I was going to hit him. One of my cousins, my older cousin, grabbed me. I was going to hit this white man because he put his hands over my grandmother's eye. Come to find out, was my grandmother's half-brother. He was a white man. His name was Logan. I come to find out he was very, very important cog in the Louisville Courier Journal. And he used to come periodically around to see how my grandmother was getting along. And of course, if you'd seen my grandmother at that time, you couldn't have told her from a white person because she's real fair. But I was going to hit that guy in the head with that rock. I didn't know no different.
That's good. Now, about when you moved to Beloit and... when you came with your grandparents.
My grandparents didn't come with me.
Oh, I see. Well, could you tell us about how you decided to come? You know, what was the situation then exactly when you came to Beloit?
Well, my grandparents were getting older, and my mother and father, my mother and stepfather were here. And they decided that they came to Louisville. My mother came to Louisville 1 year, and she'd asked me on another occasion a year or so before to come to St. Louis and live. Well, I went and stayed a little while with her, and I didn't like it. So when she came to Louisville and asked me to come to Beloit, well, I told her I'd wait. I waited until school was out, I think, and then I came. But when I came here, I guess it was... looking at the town and looking at things the way they were, I didn't mind it so much because the only thing I really hated, I was leaving my grandparents and my cousin, but they had promised me that they were coming later. And so I didn't mind it so much. But coming up here, then I began to see things and see them a little different. And then later on, my brother and I, my older brother, came from St. Louis. He and I said, well, we're going to send and get my grandparents. So we both of us went to work and we started saving our money and sent and got them.
Now, you mentioned you didn't like St. Louis or you didn't
like
the situation.
I didn't like St. Louis.
What was the problem there?
Well, I just didn't like the town, I guess. I don't know of anything else. I just didn't like the town. And well, one thing, it's too congested. See, I think that's one reason why I like this place. See, in Louisville, we wasn't right up on top of each other. The houses were spaced apart. You had room to run without, you know... Then you could hit the ground sometimes. You didn't have to stay on concrete all the time.
So So you seem not to have minded actually moving from the larger city, Louisville, and then St. Louis to the smaller city.
No, I didn't, because it was, see, we didn't live directly in a congested part of Louisville. We lived mostly on the outskirts of Louisville. It wasn't outside the city limits, but we were in a part of Louisville where we could have a little free room to run. And Bloyd, naturally, he came here while we were very... I just liked Bloyd when I got here, I guess.
Let's talk a little bit about your early impressions of Beloit. You say you liked it because it was fairly open space. Was there anything else about the town that attracted you?
I can't see where it could have been, because it wasn't too much here. Other than shows, it wasn't nothing. Schools and shows, it wasn't nothing here, because... Well, you could get out in the field and play ball or something of that kind, but you couldn't... It wasn't nothing else. Hills and hollows. Mm-hmm. There wasn't nothing wrong. You could go hunting. Of course, I didn't like to hunt, and I didn't like to fish. But I still would go along with the bunch.
What did you do for recreation then as a young boy?
Well, we played ball, or we would go around and... Well, we still had horses and things we could ride, things of that kind, but we didn't. And again, it wasn't too many. We'd get out in the field and throw footballs and things of that kind. See, it wasn't too many. Well, mostly all the kids in the neighborhood, outside of my two nephews, which one of them was much smaller than me, and the other one was pretty close to my size. But the others were white kids. Old neighborhood. And at that time, it wasn't but about two blacks and boys my size in the city. One was Smithson boy, and the other one was a boy was adopted by a man that lived way over on the west side somewhere. And very few girls.
Now, which Smithson was that, do you recall?
That was... Ralph Smithson. It wasn't him, but it was his brother. His brother died. His brother's name was Charles Smithson. But it was Ralph Smithson. It was the Smithson family that you've heard talk of. That was the family. And
now, you apparently didn't play much with white kids then.
Yeah, I played with all white kids.
Oh, you did? Okay, good.
Didn't have nothing else to play with but white kids. And Swatskis, A fellow just called me up here the other day, and I hadn't seen him or hadn't talked to him in quite a while. His name was Correll. His father used to have a pump outfit. He used to go around and drill wells. And he called me and was talking to me. Oh, quite a few whites, Perigos and things.
Did you ever experience any feeling of isolation in those early years because you were one of only a few black kids around?
No. That was almost as bad as the other day I was in court. This court deal, this lawyer from Milwaukee, it was a black man that was killed. And he was this defense lawyer for a white boy. So he said, well, you're giving me a problem. And I resented it right away. I said, how am I giving you a problem? He said, well, you're black and the man that's dead is black. I said, so what? So he got off the question right quick because, you know, because a person, as far as your color is concerned, don't mean nothing to me. And I've been that way all my life. And have had dealings with whites, and had a lot of fun with them, and I think they've taken me as what I am, and they, so that's the way it goes.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Now, What about the relationships between you when you moved in and the black people who were already here?
Well, there was such a few, they were glad to see me. And the same way went with the blacks were coming in. I was glad to see some more blacks coming in. I was glad. Because it gave me something that I could say, well, and especially if they were, turned out to be decent, well, I was tickled to death. And of course, they were rotten. I didn't want to be, but didn't want no parts of them.
Who did you look up to? Who did you respect in Beloit when you were a young boy here growing up? Who were the people who impressed you?
Outside of my
parents. Black and white.
Black and white?
And outside of your grandparents, right?
My parents?
Right.
I looked up to a man by the name of Leon Peterson, one. He's dead now. I looked up to him.
Now, why Mr. Peterson in particular?
Well, he was a very fair-minded person. To be a young man, he was a young man then. He was a very fair-minded person. And his father was a minister, but this fellow hadn't been in Beloit too long. But he was older than I am, was much older. I looked up to him. And he has given me a lot of advice and did a lot of things in my life to help me. I looked up to him. I looked up to...
Now, you say he helped you. Would you want to give a couple of examples, specific examples of things that he might have done?
He showed me different ways. Well, in fact, he taught me. See, in some of the cases, I guess I would have been like some of the rest of the fellows. I would have had hatred in my mind for the white or something of that kind, but he showed me that, the difference that it didn't mean it. And he's just a straight shooter all the way. And he did a lot of scout work. Of course, I didn't, he not with me, but I watched him do it with other kids, younger kids, younger than me, after I grew it up. And It was something about him that I really always liked. And I had men that I looked up to, I'll say one man I worked for named C.F. Hulbert. I worked for him for quite a few years, but I knew him before I started working for him. And I always admired him, admired the way he carried himself. Another man that's dead that I thought was nothing like him, he was handicapped. He was official at Fairbanks Morris, named G.B. Ingersoll. And he was white. Now, those were white. In fact, it wasn't too many blacks that I looked up to, because it wasn't too many blacks here outside of my parents. But those are the three people that I always looked up to.
Well, good, Mr. Simmons. We'll pick up this conversation another day.
Okay.
Thank you.